From KPFK, Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has joked multiple times about running for a third or fourth term. The coronavirus pandemic has sparked some Republicans to call for postponement of the 2020 general election. Some primary races have already been postponed due to the virus. In a good year, the U.S. suffers from numerous barriers to voting, problems with voting machines, voter ID laws, and even foreign interference. The strength of our democracy relies on the trust of its citizens that elections are properly conducted. Now, a new history book explores the many chapters of presidential election crises in the U.S. with some solutions for our current era. Its author is Alan Hirsch. He's an instructor in the humanities and chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College. He's the author of numerous works of legal scholarship and many books, including Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future, and For the People, What the Constitution Really Says About Your Rights. He joins me to discuss his latest book, A Short History of Presidential Election Crises and How to Prevent the Next One. Welcome to the program, Alan.
My pleasure.
So most of us who are old enough to remember, say, the 2000 election between Bush versus Gore, remember how shocking that was, that particular election was. But going back, and that was a time when we didn't even have things like internet-based foreign election interference. But going back to the earliest kinds of election-related crises, I imagine the nature of the crises that your history book explores from the early years of the U.S. were quite different, right?
Different. Some of them were even entertaining, but they were all crises. So 1800 is just our second contested election, and it produces a complete fiasco in which Thomas Jefferson and his running mate Aaron Burr actually tie for the most electoral votes, and that creates havoc for several weeks. Just a few decades later, in 1824, we have an election where no candidate gets a majority of electoral votes, and John Quincy Adams ends up president, even though he received far fewer electoral and popular votes than Andrew Jackson. In 1876, we have a crazy election, which ends up with uncannily similar to the 2000 election. It comes down to Florida, as well as two other states, with voter suppression, with chaos, with uncounted votes, and then with a partisan commission deciding the election. Then, of course, 2000. And after that, we've been fortunate. We've had elections that were so close in 2004, and especially 2016, which was not only close, but we know there were hackers trying to interfere with it. So we've had any number of close calls. So we've had what I call four actual crisis elections, and we've been spared more. And we really should be preparing for the next one.
So the main reasons for these election crises, it seems as though one precondition to any crisis is a close election, right? Where you have votes that, when it comes down to it, either electoral college votes or in particular state, a swing state where you have, you know, the very last set of votes that need to be counted, that the races are really close.
Absolutely. And that's a big problem with the Electoral College that never gets talked about, is it makes elections close. We have had something like 22 cliffhanger elections where a swing state or two, if just a few thousand or maybe 10,000 votes were flipped, you'd have a different outcome. The popular vote, by contrast, almost always produces a fairly clear winner.
So right. I mean, in 2016, we can go back and see that Hillary Clinton won 3 million more votes than Donald Trump in the popular vote. So if the Electoral College has resulted in or led to so many crises with our elections over the years, why did the founders of the nation put that in place to begin with?
Well, for a complicated series of reasons, most of which have no applicability today. To some extent, it was to protect the interests of the slave states. And there were other things they were thinking about, including, remember, at the time of the founding, only the electors cast ballots. So this was protecting against what they feared, which we would call democracy, which is everyone voting. Then you add just the wise old men who were presumably more knowledgeable and public-spirited. So there were a lot of reasons. They mostly don't hold up. And as I said, there is this major drawback of the Electoral College that no one is talking about, which is it is an invitation to hackers. It is an invitation to chaos. And unfortunately, that invitation has been accepted lately.
And so these days, that problem of hackers becomes critical, right? I mean, were there historical analogies to hackers in the past, you know, people physically going in and stealing ballots? Or is the problem of hacking unique to the internet age?
So I would say both. I'd say you've always had some degree of election chicanery. And in 1876, you certainly had people voting early and often, and things which were maybe that era's notion or idea of or analogy to hacking. But for sure, the problem is exponentially worse when you have people who remotely can influence the casting of ballots by the thousands, maybe by the millions. So I would say hacking hasn't created out of nothing a crisis. We've had crisis presidential elections pre-hacking, but it has increased the risk manifold.
So you said people, stories of people voting early and often. What do you mean?
Well, for example, in 1876, people would cross borders and vote in more than one state. And the vote early and often, that was actually a slogan that Chicago politics gave rise to. It was supposedly a joke, but in fact, that kind of thing happened. You had dead people casting ballots. All sorts of crazy stuff has happened. But again, hacking is just an invitation to have a mucked up election.
These days, Republican-dominated state legislatures have cited mass election fraud as a reason to crack down on voting using voter ID laws. In fact, Donald Trump this idea or claimed that it was because of mass illegal voting that he lost the popular vote in 2016. Is it in fact a real problem today, or is this kind of an age-old problem?
I would say that voter fraud is an age-old problem. The notion that it has become so serious as to justify these voter restriction measures is fanciful.
And that's, would you say that the Republican efforts to use this fake notion of voter fraud to crack down on voting is in itself a form of hacking?
Yes, and it's a serious problem. It's outside the scope of my book for the most part, which really is bipartisan. And I'm concerned about the kind of election crisis that can be brought about either by chicanery, by one of the political parties, or by the Russians or the Chinese or individual hackers, but also that could happen just because in the course of things, you get a razor close election and we lack a means of resolving such elections reliably. So it doesn't require some dishonesty. It doesn't require some malevolence. We are headed to a possible crisis, even if everything is above board. And that's something we really ought to be looking at before the next crisis.
What impact did the manner of the 2000 election decision have on trust, on the popular trust in elections? We basically had an election that was determined by the Supreme Court because there was no other real precedent, although there might maybe there was the one that you mentioned earlier, where was it an election commission that decided who should win?
And it ended up being fairly similar. You had a 15-person commission, which included five Supreme Court members, one of whom cast the deciding vote. So as I said, there are uncanny similarities. Wow. But you're absolutely right that there was no precedent, there is no mechanism for dealing with constitutional election crises. And this is why I wrote the book. And so in 2000, it ended up going to the Supreme Court largely by default. It was a mess, and they were willing to decide it. Nobody thinks it was a good resolution unless you're being cynical and Republicans like the outcome. But I don't think anyone thinks this is a healthy way to resolve an election crisis with a vote largely conceived of or perceived of as partisan, with all of the Republican justices voting to make George Bush president. So that was a terribly ineffective means of resolving a crisis. And yet virtually nothing has been done in the quarter century since to prepare for the next election crisis. And we know it will come. It's almost come in 2004, it almost came in 2016, and here we are months away, and thanks to the virus and thanks to the debacle in Iowa in the Democratic primary, we really ought to know that trouble is on the horizon and that we ought to be preparing for it. And so, even so, very little is happening.
So there's the issue of foreign interference, where you have internet propaganda that pushes fake news, that sways, you know, that helps micro-target voters and sways enough people in enough of the right swing states to change their minds, which is, you know, something we know happened in 2016. Then there's the Electoral College, which also, you know, I mean, those are overlapping, but still not completely the same problem, right?
Right. So there's, and then there's another problem, which is actual vote tabulation being interfered with by hackers, which there's no evidence that happened in 2016.
We know there were attempts, though, right?
We know there were attempts, and we know the technology exists to do it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of your question about the relationship between the Electoral College and then the external problem of hacking, the relationship is precisely that the Electoral College makes elections so close that they will turn on a handful of votes. So any degree of chicanery is likely to affect an election. And making things worse, we know, or the hackers know, we all know which are the swing states. So they only have to concentrate on changing a few thousand votes in a few particularly important locations, and they're very likely to change the entire outcome of an election. That's the problem the Electoral College poses in terms of election crises.
And we know that before the 2016 election, the Trump campaign hired Cambridge Analytica to do exactly that, to, you know, which essentially cut its teeth in the Brexit referendum to show that it could use the social media platforms with these very specific ads to change voters' minds. There is an effort around the country to eliminate the Electoral College state by state, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I mean, that's an interesting thing, is everyone thinks you have to have a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, but you don't. You just need enough states totaling 270 electoral votes who agree by compact with one another that they will honor the nationwide popular vote winner. They will have their state's electoral votes go to whoever wins the national vote. And there have been many states that have done that, but we're not close to 270 yet. It's not going to happen in time for 2020, but this is definitely something to keep our eyes on.
So just to remind our listeners, because there are today, you know, young people who have turned 18 this year who are going to be casting their votes this year, who were, you know, only 14 4 years ago, and who may not know exactly how the Electoral College votes. It's basically a state, a winner-take-all system where if, say, in California, if a Democrat wins that state by even, you know, 50% plus one vote, they get all Electoral College votes assigned to that state. And then whoever tallies up to more Electoral College votes wins the entire election, even if they lose the popular vote. I mean, that's a rough summary of it, basically, right?
Yeah, and you really, just the example of California points to the problem. Imagine that someone wins California by 10 votes. They get all 55 electoral votes. Now, do you think that is an invitation to fraud or hackers? It happens. California is not a problem because it will be won by the Democrat by an enormous amount.
Right. It's not a swing state. It's a reliably blue state. Certain other states are reliably red states.
Exactly. But the roughly 10 swing states, if you win them by a few votes, you get all the electoral votes. And that is like a bright neon sign to hackers or other people who want to perpetrate fraud. Here's how you do it. All you have to do is swing a few hundred votes in the state of Ohio, and you may determine who is the presidential winner. And then, of course, there's the whole other problem we haven't discussed, which is when you do have an election where, for whatever reason, it's so close, even if there's not fraud, we don't know who won, such as 2000. We have no mechanism for reliably determining who won. It is really unconscionable that we haven't addressed this problem in the 200 plus years in which we have periodically had these crisis elections.
You're talking about voting machines that don't necessarily have a paper trail or that don't properly record votes?
It could be dozens of things that cause an election to be within the margin of error, essentially literally too close to know who won. And in those cases, what do we do? How do we determine the winner? And you would think that we would have gotten a head start on this problem since starting in 1800, we have faced this problem. What happens when we wake up the day after election day, not knowing who won and having in place no method for reliably determining the winner? That's why we ended up with the Supreme Court deciding the 2000 election. There wasn't an advanced means of reliably figuring out who won.
Who is defending the Electoral College today, and on what basis?
So it's largely the small states. And well, first of all, to be perfectly frank, Republicans right now have an advantage in the Electoral College. They have won two of the last five elections, even though they lost the popular vote. So it's very, very hard to convince Republicans to get rid of the Electoral College simply for that reason. It benefits them now. But that is a short-sighted perspective because it's harmful to all of us in the big picture and the long term. But it is the small states, by and large, who have an interest in maintaining the Electoral College. At least that's the idea. I think it's largely based on a myth. Now, you will hear people say that because of the Electoral College, the candidates will campaign in tiny states, which otherwise wouldn't be worth their while because there are so few votes. But the truth is, they still don't campaign in small states. They also ignore enormous states like California and Texas and New York. The only place they campaign is in these handful of swing states. We have turned American elections into this thing where the only people who matter are one-fifth of the American people who live in 10 states. And that really does not seem smart from the standpoint of democracy. But my book points out that it's also not smart from the standpoint of preserving a reliable system of knowing who won. And that's something people have to start talking about before it's too late.
In the absence of action to eliminate the Electoral College, does your book make a recommendation on a resolution for a 2000-like crisis that doesn't rely on the Supreme Court, where we know there's a 5-4 majority, a conservative majority?
I make two recommendations for amending the Constitution, but there's probably not enough time to do that. So between now and November, what can we do? We can do something I talk about in the book, which is basically creating a tripartisan. So that's Democrats, Republicans, but it's also someone who will represent the interests of third parties. A tripartisan body whose very existence, whose very job is to resolve controversial elections. And you know, I go through some nuts and bolts in the book. I won't go, if I may mix metaphors, I won't get in the weeds now. But that is the sort of thing we need to do. We need to have this body that exists before the election, because after the election, it's too late. Now, nobody is going to trust it. Who's going to appoint this body? Who are we going to trust to do it in a fair way? Just like we don't trust the Supreme Court. You have to have a body which is set up in advance to handle this kind of thing. And it's set up, as I said, on a tripartisan basis. Mm-hmm. I'd add, it has to be given sufficient powers, power of subpoena and so forth, to power to conduct hearings. It needs to be given the powers to really get to the bottom of what is in effect a tie election.
Does this not also, however, rely on Republican cooperation and Republicans who see that they're benefiting from the current system would be less likely to actually care?
But anyone can be a loser if you get a crisis election. The Republicans have no way of knowing that next time around they won't lose when this kind of thing happens. Fraud and hacking and chicanery, it knows no political loyalty. So it really would be short-sighted for Republicans to say, we're not going to agree to a system which reliably can enable us to determine who won an election. It would be the height of cynicism, and I won't put it past anyone, but it would be extraordinarily short-sighted to not try to have a means for determining the winner of presidential elections in a fair and reliable manner.
I'm wondering if you think that there are media corporations that also count on, or maybe local media that count on the Electoral College, because if candidates end up focusing on just the swing states, which is generally what ends up happening as we get past the primary races, the handful of states get flooded with all the ad money and the commercials and all of the attention from politicians.
Oh, it's wonderful to be a swing state right now, isn't it? But you know, these are swing states now. In 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years, there will be different swing states.
Right, as
In 10 or
demographics change.
demographics change, exactly. And it may be the Democratic Party, not the Republicans, who benefit from the Electoral College in 10 or 20 and 30 years. So we really need people to step forward and say that the short-sighted benefit, the short-term benefit to one party or the other, has to be transcended by the good of the country.
You would prefer, I imagine, an elimination of the Electoral College to setting up a commission, but I suppose we need some action, right?
No, so it's two separate things. I would propose replacing the Electoral College with a national popular vote to determine who won. That will already greatly reduce the chance of a crisis election. But in case we have a crisis election, we need a pre-existing commission that can resolve disputes. So those are really the two things that we need. And my book talks about those things at length, but it also, I hope it doesn't come across as dry, because these are great stories about the 1800 election, the 1824 election, 1876. It's a wonderful history lesson to revisit these elections. And of course, 2000, which is a little too painful for some of us, but it's fascinating to go back and see all the things that had to go wrong to put us in the position we were in 2000. But things do go wrong. Stuff happens. And I hate to belabor the point, but we really ought to be prepared before the next presidential election.
Alan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today for this exclusive first interview discussing your new book. Good luck to you, and let's hope someone listens.
I hope so. A short history of presidential election crises. I really think it's timely now.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alan Hirsch, instructor in the humanities and chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College. He's the author of numerous books. We've been talking about his latest, called A Short History of Presidential Election Crises and How to Prevent the Next One. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.